Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Streams of Winter. Live Stream 3. Theon Greyjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Streams of Winter. We are Radio Westeros and this is our third live stream. And after a look at Jon Snow and Melisandre, we now turn to Theon Greyjoy in The Winds of Winter. What will be Theon's role in the upcoming book? To help me answer, here's the other half of Radio Westeros, Lady Gwyn.
Hello there. Hey, everybody. Thank you for being here. So happy to be here today with you to talk about one of my favorite characters, Theon Greyjoy, and what's going to be happening with him in The Winds of Winter. And to help us with that discussion, we are very happy to introduce our friend Emmett Booth, a.k.a. Poor Quentin, from Not a Cast Podcast. Thank you and welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to it. Theon's one of my favorite characters as well. He's one of just the most complex and well-written POVs, and I'm just excited to get into it with you.
Great. So are we. So, quick reminder about spoilers. We're going to talk about, obviously, the books and all the Winds of Winter spoiler material is fair game, and so is show discussion, although we have so much to talk about here. Just looking through the document, we might have referred to the show once, so it's not going to be a huge part of it, but it is fair game. So with that said, let's get started with Theon, and back over to you, Yoke Boy. Get us going.
Okay, so we've prepared some major talking point questions, and we're going to kind of try and make a discussion out of it. And the first topic, Theon has been a captive, first of Ramsay, then of Stannis, for quite some time now, stretching over several books. So do we see Theon escaping such bonds and being a free man once more? What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
Well, in my opinion, he's far too important of a character, and he's got way too much invested, or George has too much invested in his arc from a narrative and, you know, meta standpoint, for him to spend too much more time as a fly on the wall, which is basically what he was in A Dance with Dragons. He was just, you know, he was our point of view, although there was, you know, there was a lot of development, but he was our point of view into what was going on at Winterfell. Although we were just discussing before we started that in the very first Theon chapter, he is literally a fly on the wall. But that said, I think that might be George kind of winking at us, because I think long-term, that sort of treatment is for characters like Aerys Okart and Nerio Hota. Theon is just too major. He was there at the very beginning, and I think he's going to be there at the end. So in Winds of Winter, my opinion, he's got to progress and start becoming an active participant in his own story.
So Theon must shed his kind of captive skin. I think that of Sansa as well. I hope these two characters can kind of evolve into the next book. And Emmett, do you agree that he will become a free man? And if so, why don't you tell us your thoughts on this topic?
Absolutely. I agree with Lady Gwyn that Theon is gradually progressing to a point where he has to seize control of his own life, for better or worse. For better in that he won't be at the whim of cruel puppet masters anymore, but for worse in that it means taking responsibility for what he's done and will do next, which he's kind of still eager not to do in a lot of ways. Stannis' presence in Theon's story was felt very transitional to me. Like, neither of them particularly care what happens to the other or resonate with each other. Like, Theon's, you know, clear poles in his life have been the Greyjoys, the Starks, Ramsay. Stannis' ultimate endpoint in terms of execution and sacrifice obviously is much more focused on Shireen. I think this is kind of a holding pattern for Theon, for him to continue being fly on the wall for the moment, but ultimately it's a vessel for him to get out and away from kind of this situation of pure torment and control and allow him to try to reconcile these struggles within him. So I think, yeah, ultimately freedom both inside and outside is what Theon is heading towards. And that's not going to be a purely easy thing for him because he doesn't really want to embrace freedom right now, and he's going to have to.
And Emmett, how would you see it going down? What could set Theon free, and, you know, internally, externally? Have you got any ideas there?
Well, we have the Theon, you know, released Winds of Winter chapter where Stannis is preparing to potentially execute Theon before the local Weirwood at the Crofters village. But we also have the birds behaving very strangely and saying Theon's name and saying the tree, the tree, the tree. So they seem to be eager to get him there. And this builds, of course, on Theon seeing Bran's face and Bran seeing Theon from the Winterfell Heart Tree. So I think it seems likely that Bran and Bloodraven want to get Theon in front of that tree in some way. Now, it's entirely possible that they want him there to execute him and gain some power from King's Blood or something else, but given Bran's general nature as a character and how he seems to be speaking to Theon from these trees and birds, I think what might happen is actually Bran tries to extend mercy to Theon, to intercede with Stannis to spare his life and to give him some measure of forgiveness or some measure of freedom. I like this idea in part because I just love imagining Stannis Baratheon, his eye twitching, his sword raised, frozen in midair, as a small boy earnestly tells him from a tree that he has to choose mercy. Like, Stannis is already having bad enough talking to birds. If he has to talk to a tree, that's just going to be wonderfully awkward. But I think that would be an interesting kind of new starting point for Theon, that he's given mercy that you could say maybe he doesn't deserve, but who gets what they deserve? He's being given it, and now he has to make something from it, and it's coming from the Starks. I think that would be kind of perfect for his character.
I was wondering, you know, just talking about this, the birds and the tree and everything, the Prince of Winterfell and the Ghost of Winterfell chapters, what you're alluding to, both feature that Winterfell heart tree apparently whispering Theon's name. But I was checking out the timeline before, and for people that don't, you know, dissect every small part of the timeline, you might not realize that those chapters actually occur after the end of Bran 3, which is Bran's last chapter in A Dance with Dragons, where he starts first having that long series of visions through the Heart Tree. So this means, I think, that in Winds of Winter, we could still see Bran's side of those first, you know, interactions at Winterfell, and maybe even more, you know, leading up to the kind of things that you're talking about, especially considering the way those birds are saying Theon's name in that sample chapter. We know that Bran is out there flying around and skin-changing ravens, etc. So I wondered if this could be part of the... we know that there was a chapter, a Bran chapter, that was moved from Dance to Winds, and I wonder if that could be part of it, and that might be one of the reasons why that had to be moved, because there's something too revelatory about Theon in that chapter.
Yeah, I do wonder about that Bran chapter. I mean, what else could it be? Maybe Jojen meets, you know, this day he's going to die, but you could be on the money there. And so when we're talking about freedom and forgiveness for Theon, what opportunities will this present for his internal and external world? Emmett, take it away.
Well, forgiveness from a Stark would be a really powerful thing for Theon. I think it's, you know, not so much quite because it's like a family he abandoned as it's framed in the show, and I get why the show framed it that way. It's very emotional. There's a lot of pathos. But in the books, especially when we see with that scene in Barbary Dustin, it's more that the Starks are this impossible standard that he can never live up to. And I think getting forgiveness from them, from the Starks saying, like, Theon, it's okay that you're flawed, it's okay you couldn't live up to us, I think that would be really powerful for him, especially from Bran, the true Prince of Winterfell, you know, the kind of ironic flip side of how Theon thought of himself. Bran was the person he dethroned, whose castle he stole, and for Bran to say, you know what, it's okay, I think that would be very powerful for him. The revelation that Bran lives, that Theon didn't kill him, that would, you know, having the public community be aware of that would be very, I think, cathartic for Theon. But of course, that doesn't change what Theon did to the actual dead boys. and everyone else he hurt along the way, and that's going to become only more apparent once Bran and Rickon's survival is out in the open, so he will have to take full advantage of whatever window of freedom he can claw open thanks to Bran's mercy. It's not necessarily just going to become, you know, follow the yellow brick road from then on. He has to rebuild his identity within his own mind and public view at the same time, and that's no easy task. It's not like he's just going to be sent to a quiet cell, like Sandor, for example, where he can think about what he's done and meditate. He has to do it still in the eyes of a political community that may change their opinion on him somewhat, but is still not going to love him.
I agree, especially from the, you know, Stannis perspective. It doesn't really matter who Theon killed. Theon is a criminal, and he's a turncloak, and he's a valuable hostage, too, which Stannis has been careful to make note of. Bran and Rickon surviving might marginally change the way the Northmen feel about him, but, you know, he still has Winterfell to answer for. So remember that so far, Theon hasn't been inclined to point the finger at Ramsay. He actually confessed to killing Bran and Rickon in his Winds of Winter chapter to Stannis. He was trying to goad Stannis into killing him right then and there to save him from having to, you know, face Ramsay because he's so terrified that Ramsay might be coming after him. But, you know, I feel like he's got a... there's a few options for how he could kind of gain his freedom, which you mentioned one. There are ways I could imagine that he could escape. And there's one other option that I'm going to be cryptic because we're going to talk about it later.
And earlier we mentioned this idea that Theon could be sacrificed to placate the Northerners and also to offer something to the Red God. So if the plot was kind of hinting at this, but then turned away, why would George turn the other way and give this broken character further story? Lady Gwyn, have you got any ideas there?
Well, I think I already alluded to really what I have to say about this, which is that he's so integral to the end game. He is, in spite of his inner conflict, he's part of the Stark family. He was there with them at the beginning. We first see him on the second page of A Game of Thrones. I really think that George has committed to the character of Theon, and he's going to be there for the duration. So, as to why, if you guys have any ideas as to why, that's more about the mechanics of it.
Yeah, I agree with you that it feels to me that he's just too important to discard just yet. His arc is not done, and I feel like we've been through a lot with him, and there's got to be some kind of payoff. So I hope there is anyway, after those Reek chapters. So moving on, let's talk about in The Last Kingdom, this Netflix show, we see a medieval story about a man with split heritage, and he struggles to define himself. Here with Theon, he's split between wanting to be a Stark and a Greyjoy. He's not northern enough to be a Stark, but too Stark to be Ironborn. What is it that's so alluring about these kind of identity crisis stories? And what does that tell us about ourselves? Emmett, do you have any ideas?
You know, we like to think of ourselves as particular kinds of people. Rather than acknowledging the human heart, every single one of them, as a vessel for wildly contradictory or even oppositional forces. We are all father and mother and maiden and crone and smith and warrior and stranger. Those seven faces are actually one, as Catelyn emphasizes a couple times. We're all, as George put it, a hero on Monday and a villain on Tuesday, depending on who you ask. This is not to say that it's all a wash and we should just embrace nihilism and, you know, complete moral relativism, but we should think of ourselves not as agents of light or dark, but as battlegrounds between those forces. That's what we are. And evil, then, is less about irredeemable wickedness coming to the fore in the evil people. It's more about weakness against the same internal demons that plague the good people. The difference between good and bad people is like, you know, a couple degrees of strength against those same weaknesses and greed that inspires us all. Who you are on the given day, what the right thing is, these are constant battles with no victory. And I think you can see that really driving George's interest in Theon, that he's really moved heaven and earth to, like, keep this character working. He completely, you know, retrofitted elements of Tyrion's plot to Theon in A Clash of Kings. He had the patience to let Theon vanish from the story for the entirety of A Storm of Swords and A Feast for Crows, with the confidence that we would be with Theon when he brought him back under a completely different name. Like, that is really confident, ambitious storytelling, and I think it's all about trying to get this idea across that our understanding of Theon Greyjoy is so like incomplete and fragmented, because that's kind of what people are.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I think, how it always comes back to grayness, you know, and that mix of that, you know, like you said, the mix of light and dark, and that really embodies the inner conflict. And as we all know, those two things are the things that interest George the most.
Great points about the light and darkness. And I would say, from a story point of view, that, you know, these kinds of identity stories, a character coming from two tribes but belonging to neither, really presents a great storytelling opportunity, such as double crossing, spying, divided loyalties, and so on. And these really cause and feed into enormous internal and external conflicts, as it does with Theon. I think that's very entertaining for us. What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
Yeah, I think narrative tension is essential to good storytelling. It's the thing that keeps readers turning the page, that keeps us coming back. If there wasn't tension, conflict, dare I say drama, around a character like Theon Greyjoy, would we even care?
Probably not. I mean, you know, Theon, we talk about Theon having a remarkable character arc, one of the best in the series, but I think there's not as much, like, progression you can necessarily point to in the same way you can with a character like Jaime. I think it's more just that Theon's, the setup that you guys are talking about, this rich conflict, is so potent that you don't even need Theon necessarily to change. You just keep putting him in different situations, and that conflict is where you get the drama from. And Theon isn't so much changing who he is as a person, is just constantly going back and forth between these poles, and there's no exit for him. And that, I think, is really powerful, you know, in spite of the fact that if you just look at the narrative facts of Theon Greyjoy, he seems like kind of a shallow douche and not necessarily someone you would find to be a remarkable literary character.
Gonna confess that I didn't care for Theon in A Game of Thrones. And even in, you know, in Clash, I wouldn't say I cared for him. I would say that I felt pity for him. Obviously, it's not until he gets into these really deep, you know, deep conflicts. And
that's the design. That's George's design, isn't it? He hasn't misstepped early on with Theon. He's got you exactly where he wants you, you know. Part of the redemption story, which we'll get back to. So I was wondering, Lady Gwyn, as we're talking about identity, to what extent is this identity theme and crisis really propelling his arc and story? And how is that going to continue in the next book after everything that's happened to him?
Well, I mean, just following on from those comments I was just making, you know, about us caring about Theon and understanding his crisis is, I think, important for us to care. I expect that his inner conflicts will continue, and presumably we'll get to see more of him and Asha interacting, you know, because they're together now, and that will fuel his, you know, the sort of the Ironborn side of his conflict. He's got to be working through his PTSD. He's got to be facing all the things that he's done, as we were just talking about. And maybe more importantly, he's going to be facing the people that he's done the things to. So, you know, this is going to just pull him forward, where he's going to have to deal with things, you know, over and over as things pop up in his arc.
And there's so many potentially fascinating dynamics surrounding Theon, as you were alluding to there. And, you know, another reason to be so excited for this upcoming book. And there's so many characters, from Theon to Arya, from Jon Snow to Daenerys, who have very strong themes of identity. And George always comes back to this idea of the human heart in conflict with itself, the William Faulkner quote. And it's a relatable struggle that we can all take on board and relate to in our own ways. Patron Elisa Faison points out that the chapter titles in A Dance with Dragons have meaning, such as The Ghost in Winterfell. So, with Theon's final dance chapter being called Theon once more, can we now expect his identity to begin to kind of settle down after being kind of reshaped by the first five books? What do you think, Emmett?
It's a good question. I would say yes and no. I mean, there's a tension with Theon in that his old self was, first of all, nothing really to be proud of. But his old self already had a split identity long before Ramsay came along and made it much worse with the whole Reek thing. And that's something I think is really interesting about his character, especially going forward. The Theon we see at the end of A Dance with Dragons, who gets a Theon chapter back, that's a new identity, different from the old. Because the old Theon would not save Jane Poole, but this Theon is. It's kind of an inversion of a rose by any name would smell as sweet. The names matter here because they are conceptualizations of changing internal forces. What Theon means to Theon has changed, but, you know, he kind of needs that name back as a way to express that change, even as it's meaning something different. And you were saying about how, you know, George has us right where he wants us, and I think he's thinking so much about audience response when it comes to Theon's identity arc, and is, like, building our response into it, and is wanting us to change as much as him, that, you know, our distant relationship to him in Clash completely flips when we get to Dance. You know, the first time you read that Reek chapter and it takes you a couple paragraphs to even figure out whose head it is you're inside, George is making you question your own stable foundations and how you know who you are. And I think that's why he keeps coming back to that. It's a great literary theme, but it's also just a great way of destabilizing your audience's perspective and forcing them to challenge themselves.
What I find interesting, and this I already alluded to, this whole progression of, you know, how we feel about Theon starts with not really liking him at all, and then eventually George gets us to a point where we are actively rooting for him to win, to recover his identity, to be redeemed. I mean, you wouldn't have thought that before, at any point before A Dance with Dragons, I don't think. We might have felt pity for him because he made bad choices. Very bad choices, but it's really through this process of, you know, what we see him go through in A Dance with Dragons, and I think, getting back to the chapter titles, that those reflect that journey. You know, they obviously have dual meanings, which, you know, I won't go off on a sidebar about that, but, you know, I think as far as they pertain to Theon, you know, they're reflective of his journey. And so, yeah, that when we get that one chapter that's Theon, that he's regained a critical part of himself there, and that's obvious. But I do wonder, because he obviously has not completed his journey, if we'll get more chapters titled something besides Theon as we go forward and his journey kind of continues.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about. You know, what could the titles be, or whether, you know, he's Theon for good. I hope he's Theon for good. I'm wondering how Theon will ever reconcile his identity crisis internally and forgive himself. What do you think, Emmett?
Well, the reveal that Bran still lives might help trigger some self-reconciliation in that regard. Because Theon will have to move past the idea that he's being blamed for a crime he didn't commit. They were only Miller's boys, he tells himself, so everyone's wrong about what I did, so I don't really have to deal with what I actually did that only I know about. Once that is out in the open, he might be forced to deal with it on its own terms and allow for some kind of resolution. I don't know how direct that form takes. You know, sometimes the catharsis of dealing with your shame in public allows you to deal with what you've done. Sometimes you have to make direct redress. Other times, as we see with, like, you know, Sandor Clegane, you just need to put your head down and work for a while. You know, do good works, even if they're not directly related to what you did, and hope that that adds some joy back to the universe for what you took away.
Good karma.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Exactly. Which, you know, that can be glib to a certain extent. It doesn't help the people you hurt, but it might be the only way of internally resolving what you did.
Yeah, I like that. I think it's in the Winds chapter, he remembers seeing Asha and pouring out his story to her, and he just kind of, it just all comes out in a like word salad. He's just saying, he's so eager to tell her about the Miller's boys and the swords and the crypts and everything, all of it, Kira and the dogs, and it just goes on. He can't seem to bring himself to tell anyone else this yet. He's not quite willing to say Ramsay Bolton Snow, whatever, he did it, he's the bad guy, he's still too afraid of that, or he's still too, you know, guilty about it, what his own role has been, I guess. He doesn't feel worthy of being heard, I guess, is what I'm saying. So instead, he sits there and accepts things like Turncloak, Kinslayer, which, you know, he kind of, even in Dance with Dragons, he kind of feebly protests that he's not a Kinslayer, but then he's just like, yeah, okay, yeah, Kinslayer. So I think, you know, that part of him that really wants to be heard, I like this idea that he has to deal with the Miller's boys on their own terms and with what he did do at Winterfell that led to what Ramsay did at Winterfell, because obviously direct causality there, before he can actually forgive himself. And what I wonder is if there's someone who's going to mediate or attest to all of these things, you know, just kind of help him along, because he seems so unable to vocalize on his own at this point. So is there someone that might turn up that's turns out to be an ally in helping him to face the truth of it all? And, you know, that could be Bran, which is, you know, something we've been talking to. But there are some other interesting candidates who were also witnesses to what happened at Winterfell in Mira Reed, in Asha, Wex Pike, who is mute but has now learned to write. So, you know, there's some other alternatives for people that could have still a surprising impact on his arc, I think.
Yeah, so will Theon get any kind of external help? That is an interesting thing to think about. I'm so glad that we do have his POV, so we can be privy to all of his internal growth through wins that we think is coming up, and I look forward to that a lot. But while Theon might be looking to forgive himself, other people might have other ideas about how he might come in useful to them. So in A Feast for Crows, we learn the story of Torgon Latecomer. I'm sure all of you remember this story, which initially seemed like a possible blueprint for Theon's future. Do we agree or not that it could be possibly some kind of blueprint? Lady Gwyn, what do you think?
Well, I think when I first read that, I thought, oh, yeah, that's it. But the more I've studied Theon, and actually Asha as well, I have come to the conclusion that Torgon Latecomer is about what Asha wants. It's not necessarily about what Theon wants. In fact, I think as much as, you know, Theon has this identity crisis where he wanted to be Ironborn and he wanted to be a prince and all this stuff, I think right now, after everything he's been through, it's kind of the last thing he wants. So I think the purpose of Torgon Latecomer is going to be more in Asha's arc, maybe providing a path for her to possibly defeat Euron at some, you know, some point in the future.
But not in a way that kind of takes over Theon's story. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think Theon has his own story. Yeah.
Okay. I can agree with that.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And so let's talk about Asha. How far do we think her related ambitions will stretch? Emmett, what do you think?
Well, I agree. I mean, this might end up being more of a technicality in Theon's story, this whole latecomer aspect, and might be more of a focus in Asha's story and just a way of getting accomplished what she needs to. Obviously, the timeline isn't going to be the same as the show, because in the show, Theon took the leap from Winterfell, and then the Kingsmoot happened, and he was there for it. But I could see something similar to the show scene where Theon is put forward, but ultimately kind of cedes actual rule to Asha. And maybe he's more framed religiously, like his uncle, Saint Theon, who suffered and was redeemed, and he can redeem the Iron Islands of their suffering, more than he is like the actual nuts and bolts day-to-day ruler. Because Theon has no interest in that and probably wouldn't be good at it. And that seems like it might be more Asha or Roderick the Reader. Maybe it's similar to how Baelor the Blessed, another kind of religiously framed, suffering for your sins kind of leader. But, you know, the actual guy running the kingdom was Viserys II, who knew what he was doing with the books.
Right.
So that might be more kind of the division of power we see with the Ironborn. After all, there used to be, what was it, the Salt King and the Rock King for the Iron Islands. They had the two kinds of, you know, two kinds of power. Maybe we're looking at that.
Sure, yeah. I wonder if Theon's existence is used as, you know, just the fact that he's alive and the Torgon story as a precedent is just some used to invalidate that Kingsmoot, and, you know, like, then there he is. And I was thinking about this, and I did realize that this actually is very similar to how it played out in the show, although, like you said, the timeline is different and everything. But, you know, there's Theon just going, yeah, it's my sister. She's
She rules.
She's your queen. So, you know, I definitely think and hope that something like that happens, although I don't want to go too deep on Asha, because we're going to be talking about her next week.
Yeah, let's hold back, because next week we're doing Asha, and that's also why we've avoided largely talking about the Battle on the Ice or the Battle for Winterfell with Stannis, because we know it's from Asha's POV, so next time. But anyway, back to Theon. He was badly disfigured by Ramsay, putting it mildly. As a character, he was greatly punished following the disastrous takeover of Winterfell. So let's talk about penance and forgiveness from other people. At what point will he achieve forgiveness from those around him? What do you think, Emmett?
Well, I mean, you have his arc in A Dance with Dragons building up to the moment that he leaps with Jane Poole from the walls. And you have the setup for that being that Mance and his spear wives are saving, quote-unquote, Arya Stark. Who knows if Mance really thinks it's her or knows it's her, but that's what the pretense is. That's what the mission is about. It's not saving Jane Poole. It's saving the person she's pretending to be, Arya Stark. Just like Theon, just like Reek, you know, is Theon, who's pretending to be Reek, who was always pretending to be this Ironborn guy named Theon, all these identity shell games these characters are playing. And the fact that Theon, unlike Mance, saved Jane despite knowing she's not Arya, because he knows she's not Arya and wants to save the person underneath, that seems crucial to me. That the idea of how Stark was projected onto her and she suffers for it. And Theon relates to that, and he gets her out of there, away from the man who abused them both. It's as if he's acknowledging the worth of humanity under identity, under the shadow on the wall, under the power plays of the Game of Thrones, in which the innocent suffer. And that applies to him as well, that he has suffered under the cloak of his identity, but also to the boys he killed, that he not only killed these Miller's boys, but no one can mourn for them properly because no one knows that's who he killed. And no one can properly relate to Jane Poole because everyone's pretending she's Arya Stark. And I think Theon achieving some kind of forgiveness is about tapping through that and getting through that redemption and that heroic act. It's caught up with his need to reckon with mortality and with who he's been. And it's why he immediately ends up a prisoner of Stannis, who tells him, no, you didn't fly, you fell, like Bran, like every other broken man. It was actually Crowfood Umber who saved the Jane Poole because he picked you two up. Otherwise, the phrase would have grabbed you immediately. And that kind of frames Theon's act as not being about saving the day on his own, but about the decision to do it. And I think maybe the accumulated weight of those decisions and people seeing them, maybe that's what leads to forgiveness.
I definitely think that you know, he showed great courage there, and more so than, you know, the more you dig into it and try and kind of peel the layers back, the courage of being able to do that is something tremendous. And I think that he really did in that moment when he was saving Jane kind of embody that, you know, Ned's maxim about being courageous when you're afraid, because he is probably the most afraid a human being can be whenever Ramsay's in the house, right? So I think going forward, he's going to be proving himself in some equally courageous way, you know, and when he's at his most terrified, which will be saying an awful lot, he'll do something that will benefit House Stark or Winterfell or the North or,
Yeah, the greater good. And Lady Gwyn, do you think that Theon has always wanted to be a hero, and in that's his course that he sets on? Do you think deep down that was part of what was driving him?
Theon always wanted to be a hero. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you just roll it back to the, you know, in the Wolf's Wood when he shot the wildlings who were holding Bran, and you know, Rob was so pissed off at him, but really that and so many other things that Theon has done in his arc have come from his deep desire to be a hero. He even just going to the Iron Islands to treat with his father, you know, he naively thought his father was gonna listen to him and come on board, and he was gonna be a big hero for Rob and Rob's cause. I mean, you know, until he realized that was a dead end for him, and he had to choose another path to being a hero. So yeah, I think definitely that's going to end up being a huge part of where he's going.
I really hope this is ultimately a hero story for sure. It'd be so interesting. But on his way to potentially being a hero, he has suffered a lot. So there's much suffering in these books, but Theon is, you know, one of the characters that's gone through the most. Why does George introduce suffering and torture into arcs like Jamie and Theon's, you know, in terms of character development? What can it kind of offer rather than being just gratuitous violence? Have you got any thoughts on that, Emmett?
It's an interesting question with Theon specifically, because while we do see gratuitous violence at the end of his Clash arc and throughout his Dance arc, the most, you know, awful and soul-shattering violence that happens to Theon happens completely off-page, and our imagination has to fill it in, which in a way kind of implicates us, not morally, but it forces us to be the one to think of what might have happened to Theon, and forces us to be in this kind of intimate place with him. So I think George is in part doing that, but I think also the element of torture is there to represent the impossibility of achieving justice in an unjust world in which escalation of violence is the only tool powerful people seem to take seriously. Jaime and Theon have committed real crimes that cry out for some kind of redress, but there is no system in their world that can deal with them in such a way that achieves justice. Like, the closest thing we see to, like, a just court is the Brotherhood's court, and that still turns really unjust when it comes to the specific case of Sandor Clegane. Everything just gets worse in these situations. And what I think that means in terms of character development is that only Jaime and Theon and Sandor can work out their own redemption. Suffering can't do it, and society can't do it. It has to be their desire for it, because that's the only thing that really is going to mean anything for them.
Do you think it kind of primes us to excuse them of past deeds or something like that? Do you think it kind of allows us to forgive them, the reader to forgive them because of what they've undergone?
I think it, for me personally, convinces me that I have to trust Theon Greyjoy's idea of what a better Theon Greyjoy would be, because I can't trust Ramsay's idea of what a better Theon Greyjoy would be, or Stannis's, or really even the people I like in the North, because they're, you know, their better version of Theon is someone who's dead. So as flawed and messed up as the mind of Theon Greyjoy is, it's still the only place a better version of Theon is going to come from, and that's way harder if you torture him. Like, even putting aside just the sheer awfulness of torture in itself, it makes it way harder for you to improve yourself because you're psychologically just so frayed and torn and broken. It's going to be so much harder for Theon, even if he wants to do that. And I think that's part of what George is getting at, not mitigating his past crimes, but saying this has not helped make him a better person. It's made him it much harder, and it's enabled terrible people even worse than him.
Excellent. And talking of characters that have suffered a fair amount, when I was rereading the first Reek chapter, I was reminded very much of Gollum. So, Lady Gwyn, can you tell us, could Reek be the George R.R. Martin answer to Gollum?
Yeah. First, I want to say that just an observation about Reek, because I find it very fascinating that the original Reek was a mentor to Ramsay and must have had some kind of power over him, you know, in the way that mentors do. If we talk about heroes' journeys, you know, you have a mentor and a student, and as disgusting as their relationship probably was, he was, you know, the original Reek was above Ramsay because he's teaching him how to do these things. But then we learn that Ramsay traded clothes with him at this key moment, which led to Reek's death. Ramsay literally took on, you know, his mentor's identity in order to save his skin. So that's another, you know, it's another sort of perversion of a hero's journey, because it's the student surpassing the master. But the next time we see Reek, Ramsay has turned him into a pet, which just says so much about the power dynamics that someone like Ramsay serves. Now, that's all about Ramsay. So as far as Reek and Reek, Theon Reek being Gollum, I think in the most Martinian of ways, he's similar to Gollum in that, you know, he's a pathetic creature who has been changed by the experiences he's undergone. And he likely has a role to play in the denouement. So yeah, they definitely have, you know, similar beats in their arcs, but he's a version of Gollum that's going to have a lot more agency than poor Sméagol ever did. And he's not going to be Reek by the time he gets to that point. Unlike Gollum, Sméagol, he's going to get to that point and be Theon, be hopefully what everything we're saying, that he will have found redemption before he gets to that.
Yeah. So Theon was just going through a Gollum phase. That's it. He's going to grow out of it. just a teenage phase. Okay. So patron Christine wonders about Theon and the theme of redemption. So let's go there. There are several characters with redemptive beats in their arcs, such as Jaime and Sandor. But when everyone's story is finally done, will Theon Greyjoy's journey be the true redemptive arc in the series? So what do you make of that, Emmett?
It's always the interplay between your individual arc and how you feel about yourself, and then your place in the big picture and what the relationship between those two things is. I mean, there was a reckoning in the cases of Jaime and Sandor with that big picture, in terms of how society has remade them in its own violent image, even as they've resisted its hypocrisies as best they can. They carry with them the knowledge that all of this is bullshit. That's what they keep saying over and over. Society is pretense laid over barbarism, and at least barbarism has honesty of purpose. And both of them are then forced to face the fact that they can still choose to do good in this fallen world. I think Theon has just reached that point. He's yet to connect the dots between his own suffering, his own crimes, and the potential for a better world. I think we might see him build up that perspective over the Winds of Winter. Like, what is the kind of society that, you know, led me down the path I led, that led Ramsay down the path he led? Because it's like, the comparison to Gollum is interesting because there's no ring, right? There's no, like, locus of easily identifiable thing you can point to. That's what made Gollum the way he was. That's the symbol of power. That isn't really there for Theon. It's this evanescent sense of who I am and who I'm supposed to be. So maybe the key for Theon's next step is he has to identify something specific. He has to keep it away from free-floating and says, I have to change the world somehow. I have to make the Iron Islands better. I have to, you know, replace my nightmarish uncle. I have to burn the Ring of Power. I have to find something concrete I can do.
Excellent. When I think of like the classic redemption arc, I always think of Anakin Skywalker, mm-hmm. Darth Vader, and I see it. You know, some commonalities. They start off as kind of troubled kids. They get offered a decent path in life, really, but you know the darker side gets them, and you know they go through different kind of dark phases. But ultimately, they could do one last, you know, shot of redemption at the end. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's how Theon is portrayed. So that'd be my kind of pop culture comparison. Lady Gwyn, what do you think about redemption arcs?
You know, I think there's various types of redemption, aren't there? I mean, last week we talked about Melisandre and redemption through the possibility of redemption through self-sacrifice. You know, is redemption through action, through, you know, an active arc, a series of things that build. You know, I could see actually both coming into play with Theon. The show gave us a Theon Greyjoy who died defending Bran from the Night's King, but in a way that to me felt slightly hollow. I mean, did it matter in the end that he died? I mean, yeah. To him, I mean, he chose to be there and he chose to make that stand. I mean, and those were great choices. But there was no sort of tangible effect. And I came away from that craving more. So I think that George's ending will not feel pointless, if you will, I think that Theon's going to really do something that matters in order to get to that final point of his arc, which, let's face it, I do anticipate that his redemption arc is leading towards redemption death, which is what we, you know, apparently what we saw in the show, but I don't think it will have that hollow kind of feel to it.
Okay, so maybe something with a bit more meaning you're hoping for. So while we're talking about kind of great redemptive acts that could happen, this is really even beyond the scope of Winds of Winter now. But anyway, let's go there. So some fans wonder, you know, us included, whether Theon, this renowned archer in the early story, has still got what it takes to loose fateful dragonglass-tipped arrow one last time. And we made a poll about it. Take it away, Lady Gwyn.
That's right. Our poll was, does Theon have one last heroic arrow shot in him? You know, he's been noted through his arc to be a fantastic archer. And we had 506 people vote. And essentially, it was came down to a margin of 4-1. 79.6 said yes, he does, and 20.4 said no. The yes people, I want to just add, there was one comment to it. I am sorry, I didn't write down who it came from. Who said, I think this is actually why Theon was written that way, and I couldn't agree more.
You mean as an archer?
As an archer, right. Yes. I think that part is there in his arc for a reason. So
that makes sense to me, especially doesn't Glendon Ball have only 7 fingernails, right? In the Mystery Knight,
yeah.
When he makes his shot. Yep. So I definitely see that connection. You know, there's always the question of how practical a given thing is, but obviously it's a fictional universe if George wants to write an event because he feels it resonates with the character with a larger story. He can fudge the details to make it make sense. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that definitely links up. Theon's skill with a bow has been consistent, as you said, Lady Gwyn, from early on in the Wolfswood in book one, even before he was a POV. Mm-hmm. And with his uncle hanging around with the others on the march, there's plenty of ripe targets, plenty of important people to shoot.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you know, we also have something I would like to point out that we talked about this in our Theon episode, that it's been noted that the Night's Watch is critically short of archers, and the importance of archers on top of the wall defensively when you have enemies attacking from there's really only one way to defend yourself from 700 feet in the air, and that's with a good contingent of bowmen. So Yokeboy, that brings us to our next point of discussion, doesn't it?
Yeah, good segue. So patron Judson Bates wonders about Theon and the Night's Watch. So when Theon was inside Winterfell as an invader, Maester Luwin advised him to join the Night's Watch because, guess what? It's a place of forgiving previous sins and tabula rasa, etc. Do we think we could see Theon headed that way during the Winds of Winter as a kind of way of regaining honour and also gaining forgiveness? What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
I wrote in the document two words, and they are, hell yes.
That's affirmative.
<That's it>.
Well, yeah, I think I would like that. I'm not sure that it's going to happen. To kind of lean on the show a bit, the portrayal in the show was almost like the people standing against the others at Winterfell in this kind of last stand situation had become the Night's Watch. You know, you didn't have to say your vows. If you were there and you're going to give your life and you're going to stand up against these demons, then, you know, you're one of the gang. So I would say that I could see him becoming like the Night's Watch in spirit, but not really saying the vows.
I agree with you there. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say the show kind of gave up on the Night's Watch, though, really.
True.
So, I mean, we have, I pointed out a couple streams ago that how much, you know, relatively speaking, you know, narrative, we have so much more than what the show gave us, because they got to through five books and then squashed all the rest into, you know, like what, two seasons, which were short. And anyways, I just think there's so much more space to tell that story that it's possible the Night's Watch will remain relevant. So
I definitely think that's, especially with the multiple castles and so many secondary characters. But I like the idea that, yeah, Theon, you know, I mean, the Night's Watch is, you know, kind of where you go to wash away your sins, but no one really forgets who you are or where you came from, and they definitely make sure you know it. You know, they keep calling him Lord Snow for a reason. I don't think anyone really forget when Theon did, so maybe he has to stay at Winterfell where the stuff happened, you know, and actually face it and actually confront it, not just go into exile. And yeah, maybe, yeah, having the stand against the others there would then fit that. He can still do the larger sacrificial purpose of the Night's Watch, but in a place that means something to him. I think that could be really good.
Yeah, I like it. I like the, you know, in the Stark home, back where he kind of misstepped, let's say.
Misstepped.
Earning some kind of final forgiveness and a last hurrah, Theon Greyjoy.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, it's both paradise and hell for him. That's the great thing about Winterfell for Theon. It's the only place he's ever known happiness, and also, like, the Garden of Eden he utterly burned down. So it's, you know, he has to resolve that somehow.
It's his home, isn't it, really? It's his home. Okay, so really enjoyed the discussion so far. This is the last talking point. After the emotional and physical torment that Theon's undergone, I'd like to know, what's it like to be Theon Greyjoy, you know, heading into the Winds of Winter and beyond? What's it like to be on Theon's head after he's just escaped Winterfell and joined up with Stannis? Lady Gwyn, what do you think?
Gosh, it's dark. He has PTSD. You know, he's, I can't even imagine what it's like to be Theon Greyjoy. I actually honestly tried, and I just kept coming up with, like, oh. But what I thought of when I was trying to think about this is, a quote from George about the Winds of Winter, where he said that it's going to get worse before it gets better for a lot of characters. And I mean, in general, he's talking about the narrative, but he said specifically a lot of his characters are going to experience very dark places. And actually, it's not going to be the happy kind of resolution. I don't think we're going to see those things in the Winds of Winter that we want to see. So While some characters might be improving, a lot of them are going to kind of stay in darkness or maybe get worse. And I thought, how the heck could things get worse for Theon? Maybe we could speculate on how things could actually get
Getting dragged into the light might hurt too. Like thinking about Jaime, you know, he went through the pain of losing his hand, but then he had to relive what happened with Aerys, which you get the sense in that bathhouse he has not really thought in detail about this for a very long time.
Yeah,
and, but he has to in order to get better, in order to, you know, reclaim his identity, in order to have something worth living for. Maybe Theon has to go through a version of that, you know, has to relive what he's done in a way he hasn't been able to do. But, you know, I also think about how in that first Reek chapter, just like coming up into the world again in like fresh air and moonlight, that just totally dazzled him and threw him off. And there's that part in the Forsaken, Aeron Dampier's released Winds of Winter chapter, when he's after like spending, I think, like weeks chained down in the hold of the silence, he's brought up, and just the smell of the salt air makes him cry. And I wonder if we're going to see like just little details like that in Theon's chapters, like just little physical things, like just the world he was denied by Ramsay, the ordinary banal world he used to take for granted. Like he might look at like a candle with like just dumbstruck awe and think how beautiful it is. Like I think that might be kind of the grace notes in his chapters. Like obviously the big picture stuff might still get worse before it gets better, but I think not just again when he's not a prisoner anymore, I think that's going to feel so new and revelatory to him.
Just to pick up on something you said earlier, Emmett, once Theon finally deals with what he's been through with Ramsay, he's then back to where he began with this identity split, which was never resolved, which needs resolved. So he's gonna have to get back to the thing which drove him in the first place, this huge problem in his mind.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to have to get back to that. And with a sense of the stakes of what happened last time he tried to resolve this. And I think, again, I think it's this like dialectical process where a new Theon is produced, like not an identity he's going to get back to, but this completely new person who's bearing this name. And I think that it's going to be a lot of rebirth imagery, I imagine, is what we're going to be seeing for Theon in the Winds of Winter. Well, at the same time, a lot of sense of how far he has to go, because yeah, he just ends up another prisoner of Stannis who doesn't like him any more than Ramsay did. So I think it's this tension of Theon trying to move forward and dealing with what's been done. I think that's gonna be the feeling. And like Lady Gwyn said, that's gonna feel really dark, but also like, you know, Theon's dance chapters, they felt like being in a tiny little box, like you're just being squeezed into his head. And I think we're gonna see some more the imagery of freedom for better or worse, as terrifying as it can be. I think is gonna be the big note of Theon's chapters.
Okay, and if Theon really needs to kind of shed this Ramsay phase as much as is possible, given what was done to him, Lady Gwyn, what needs to happen so he can kind of move on from all that trauma related to Ramsay? What's the plot point that's going to kind of heal him the most?
Well, I think there's only one thing that's going to really allow Theon to release that fear that's hanging over him right now through the PTSD, that he is going to end up back in the Valley of Shadow again, and that is going to be Ramsay's death. So, you know, that's really the one thing that he really needs to move beyond, and I don't think it's going to come from him. We have our theory how that will happen. We'll be talking about it in a few weeks with a different character. But, but I definitely think that'll be something that finally allows him to go, oh, okay, I might be safe now. And maybe I can focus on
anything else.
Maybe that's the shining light of hope in this upcoming book, Ramsay's Death.
Exactly.
That's about as good as it's going to get for us.
Can't get any better. And yeah, that he's safe from Ramsay, and also he can go, oh, Ramsay's not a divine force sent to punish me for my sins. He's a person, just like me.
Great.
And I think that could really help him.
Mortal. Yeah, exactly. In the end, he was just a man whose dogs ate him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Okay, so with that, the death of Ramsay, let's bring things to a close. Emmett, it's been great having you on. You've been a great guest. Thank you very much. I loved your insight today. why don't you spend a minute telling us about your podcast and your blog and any other creative things that you're up to?
Well, thank you so much. It was an utter joy to be with you, both of you folks, as always. So can't wait to be with you again. You can find me at Poor Quentin on Twitter. The podcast I do is Not a Cast with Brendan B. Fish, a.k.a. Jeff Hartline, who I tolerate and love, as do we all. pillar of the fandom, of course. So we've been going through the series chapter by chapter. We're a little over halfway through Clash of Kings now. So you can find us at Not a Cast, A-S-O-I-A-F, on Twitter. The actual other episodes are at Notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, .podbean.com. We have a Patreon where people get early episodes and bonus episodes and access to our Slack. That's at patreon.com/Notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F. And I'm also at poorquentin.com these days. I've only done one essay on there so far, but more will come when I feel the need to do so. So that's where you can find me, folks.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you for being here. Thank all you folks who are watching live right now for being here. Thank you and hello from the past to everyone who will watch this or listen to this pre-recorded, because it will be out as a podcast within the next couple of days, and obviously available to consume on YouTube for all time. So thanks to anyone who watches this in the future. Next week we will be back with another live stream, same time, same place. We're going to be talking about Asha Greyjoy, and our guest next week is going to be Aziz from History of Westeros. So we're very excited to come back and kind of continue this, some of the same themes that we might have talked about today, and obviously more getting into the Battle on the Ice. So
excellent. Yeah, we'll be back next week and every Saturday for the foreseeable future, talking the Winds of Winter, POVs, as we continue to weather the current storm. Don't forget to hit the like and subscribe button, and catch Lady Gwyn on History of Westeros channel tomorrow at 3 for the Valyrie Redis, a Storm of Swords wrap-up. And I want everyone to stay safe, because we love you all in the fandom, and see you next time.
Yeah, bye for now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.